Yes, and that you would write your word upon our hearts. Change us. In your name we pray. Amen. Today is a holiday, actually, that is second only to Christmas and Easter. And the holiday is such that, this morning I was walking Yellow Dog on Broadway, and as I began to think through the implications of this holiday, I began to weep with joy. I mean, I'm not the cowardly lion, right? But I have a tail, but, I was using the Yellow Dog's tail, I was so moved. And then this morning, as I was thinking, I was sitting in my office thinking through my sermon, there's not many things that will keep my children from just barging in on me. And yet I had the piece from the interlude is actually part of Mendelssohn's Fifth Symphony, which is Ein fester Berg ist our God, a mighty fortress is our God. You see, today is Reformation Sunday, and the girls walked up. They came barging up, Daddy! And I had this symphony blaring, and I was standing at the window just crying, and it was for the first time, and I can remember in a long time, they just stopped. As if there were a force field, and it was almost like, hey, he's having a moment. Let's go down, Today, the important holiday is not Halloween. Reformation Sunday. You notice on the beginning of your order to worship, it says that. And what is it? What is it a holiday of? Life magazine put it up there as one of the top two or three events in the millennium. Besides the printing press, it should probably be number one. Why? How did it happen? What happened? Love you guys are going, come on, throw me a bone. What are you talking about? You see, 15, 10, 11, or 12, this young guy named Martin Luther was going to law school. And his whole life, he was pretty tortured, by his conscience, and he always felt guilty, and he always felt terrible, and his family was superstitious. And, he was driving home, he was riding home from law school on his horse one day, and a great thunderstorm came. And a bolt of lightning came and struck so hard that it knocked him from his horse, and he screamed out, Saint Anne, if you will deliver me, I will become a monk. And all of you are going, why Saint Anne, right? You'll find out. He would ask that question later as well. And he went home and told his father, I know you've plunked down a lot of money for me to go to law school, and my big textbook cost the family their fortune, but I promised Saint Anne I'm going to become a monk. And his dad said, well, promises are promises, so you need to go become a monk. And Martin Luther was such a genius that he entered seminary, like a lot of people who don't understand the gospel and are looking for some kind of help. He entered seminary, and he's such a genius that he gets all his degrees, and he very quickly becomes a doctor of theology. And if he's this doctor of theology, he becomes angry and hateful. And he becomes angry and hateful. Because he starts reading his Bible. And he reads his Bible, and he gets to this place in Romans. And, Romans 1:16, the Apostle Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew and then for the Gentile. And then the next line says, for in it, that is the gospel, the justice or righteousness of God is revealed. And Martin Luther writes his own story, and he said, as I looked at that phrase, the justice of God, I hated it. Because when I thought of the justice of God, all I could think of was that God was just and holy and he punishes sinners, and I, even though I'm a monk, don't have what it takes. And who is this God who would call me to be pure and holy and when he knows I don't have what it takes? He says, I hated that phrase. And he says that I hated the God who wrote it. He's a priest, guys. But then he reads the next line. And the next line says, for the righteous shall live by faith. And he goes, what does that mean? He says, the righteousness of God is revealed in it, the gospel, and the righteous shall live by faith. So what is the connection between the righteousness of God and me being righteous and living by faith? And all of a sudden it hits him. That God's justice is not the justice which punishes, but it's a passive justice. It's a justice, a righteousness that he gives to me. How did he give it to me? By faith. But if I would just trust his promise that I don't have to work for his righteousness. I don't have to work to be in right relationship with him. But he just gives it to me. He plunks it down free. It's gratis. He just lays it on me. And he says, as soon as he got that, he says, from then on, I looked at these words. He says, I became born again. He says, and the gates of heaven were thrown open for me. And every time I looked at these words, the justice of God, they caused me to weep for joy because of the justice or the justification, the righteousness that had been imputed to me. What he means by that is he finally figured out that what the Bible teaches is that you can't work to be in right relationship with God. It's just you don't have what it takes if you're honest. So you need someone else's works. And what Jesus has done is he did those works. He lived the perfect life and he died on the cross and he rose from the dead. And for anyone who's willing to believe him, God will impute to you or credit to you Jesus' righteousness. And Martin Luther said, If works can't get us into heaven and works can't get us better standing with God, but it simply is believing the gospel, that changes everything. And so he wrote down some thoughts. 95 of them, to be exact. And he really wasn't trying to be a troublemaker. He just walked up to Wittenberg door, like any college where you have posters for keg parties and concerts, and he put the 95 theses up there. Because he just wanted to talk about it. And the thesis basically said, hey, if the gospel's true, we can't sell indulgences anymore. If the gospel's true, we can't manipulate people by guilt because Jesus just proclaims them righteous. And if they're righteous, they don't have anything to be guilty about. And really, the church at that time didn't do anything about it. But you know what caused them to have to deal with it? It was the printing press. You see, because people took those theses off the door and they began to print them in German instead of Latin. And everyone began to read them, and all the people's lives began to be changed. And they said, if the gospel is true, I don't have to be manipulated by the church anymore, and religion doesn't matter anymore. And as you can imagine, all hell broke loose. And the church called Martin Luther, and they said, Martin died of worms. So they made him stand up, and they had all his books. And they said, Martin Luther, your teachings have caused a lot of trouble. We want you to recant. We want you to rescind them, because if you rescind them, the people respect you, and they'll all calm down. And Martin Luther said, unless you can convince me by reason or by the scriptures that I am wrong, I can do no other. And then he said, here I stand. God help me. And from that point on, the history of the world has been different. It's been utterly different. You wouldn't be here in America if that didn't happen. And the beauty of it is, you see, I'm preaching through Genesis. The beauty of it is this. As we look at Martin Luther and we go, man, that's beautiful. He got that from the Apostle Paul. He studied the book of Romans, and that's where the gospel is. But you know where the Apostle Paul got it from? Abraham. The Apostle Paul. When the Apostle Paul starts talking about, you know what it means to believe the gospel, to be justified free without charge? He says in chapter 4 of Romans, he says, consider Abraham. Running. Well, that's what we're going to talk about today, Genesis 15, 1 through 6. It's sort of like the paradigmatic turning point almost in all the Bible, at least at that point. Look at your announcement sheet, or if you have Bibles, Genesis 15, 1 through 6 says this, after this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward. But Abram said, O sovereign Lord, what can you give me? Since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, you have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir. Then the word of the Lord came to him, this man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir. He took him outside and said, look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you could count them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. In verse 6, Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. You know, chapter 15 starts and says, after this, the word of the Lord came to Abram and says, Abram, do not fear. I am your shield and your great reward. Why would God come and say that to him? Remember a few weeks ago, the historic Melchizedek sermon, right? Remember, the king of Sodom and Chedor Laomer, all these guys, they came in and they invaded Sodom where Lot was living, and Abraham went in and he rescued Lot. He defeated all of these great kings. And he not only rescued Lot, but he gave up the stuff to the king of Sodom. And so Abram has a problem for one. He's made many enemies. The people whom he defeated would be his enemies, and he would be afraid that they would retaliate. But also the people whom he rescued, the king of Sodom and all those guys, they would be afraid of Abram. And so they would say, if Abram can beat these guys, perhaps we should kill Abram so we don't have to worry about him taking over us. So Abram would have had very real reason to fear for his life. And also, if you remember, when he rescued Lot and the king of Sodom and all these guys, the king of Sodom says, hey, I'll give you all the stuff here. And what does Abram say? I'm not going to take anything. He gives up all of the reward. He gives up all the spoils, if you will. And so he has given up, he now has many enemies, and he's given up all the money and girls, if you will. And God comes and he says, Abram, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. I'm your shield, and I'm your reward. And Abram's response is very interesting. Because if God came to you and said, you know, don't worry about anything. I'm going to be your shield, and I'm going to be your reward. What would you say? It was me. I just go, beautiful. I got nothing to worry about. Well, what does Abram say? Look at the next few verses. Abram speaks and says, but Abram said, O sovereign Lord, what can you give me, since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus. What happened? What is Abram getting at here? God says, I'm going to be your shield, and I'm going to give you everything you need. And Abram says, what can you give me? Because I don't even have an heir. Why is Abram fixated on the heir? Why is the heir so important? Above everything else, above all the promises, Abram latches on to this promise of the heir. Why is that infinitely important? And the answer is this. It's because Abram has a much bigger problem than whether or not he's going to be attacked from the outside. Abram has a much bigger problem than whether he's going to be poor or not. Abram's big, huge, insurmountable problem is his sin. Abram's problem is his sin. And the problem started, if you remember, back in Genesis 3. With Adam and Eve. Remember Adam and Eve? God put them in the garden and said, Adam and Eve, do not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or else you will die. What happened? They ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and guess what God says? Cursed are you. And of course, you know, their response at first was probably, dang. But what does God say immediately? He says, Adam and Eve, I'm going to fix the problem. The seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. Eve, your seed, your offspring, through your offspring, I'm going to fix the problem of sin. And Adam and Eve believed God. You know how we know they believed God? Because at that point, Eve didn't have a name yet. And Adam named her at that point, and he said, your name is Eve. You know what Eve means? The mother of all living. Very hopeful name. And it even gets more hopeful, because you know what the word Cain means? Their first son, Cain. You know what that means? Here he is. That's what Cain means. You see, God said, I'm going to fix the problem with your offspring. And they had their first son, and the first son was born, and they named him. Here he is. Now, the object of their faith was a little misplaced, if you know the history of Cain and Abel. However, the subject, or what they were looking forward to, they weren't wrong. That it would be a seed of Eve. One of her children ultimately would fix the problem of sin. And so you get to the time of Abram, and God comes and he makes all of these promises, and Abram latches onto one of them more than all of the others. What is it? The promise of the seed. Because remember, God said, Abram, I'm going to give you an heir or a seed, and through him all the nations in the earth will be blessed. All the families in the earth are going to be blessed. And so Abram, God has come to Abram, and he's made him these big promises to keep him safe from affliction and to provide for him. And Abram is worried about something much bigger. He's sort of like Robinson Crusoe, right? If you've read Robinson Crusoe, you've heard me tell the story before. In Robinson Crusoe, there's this great passage. It's sort of written like a journal. And on July 4th, that journal entry, he has been through everything, right? He's been shipwrecked. He's had dealt with cannibals. He had to deal with cats, right? If you read it, he was overrun by cats and then rats and everything else. It was terrible. And then he goes going to look through his old ship, and he finds the Bible. And Crusoe begins to read the Bible, and it says that he becomes convicted of his sin. And then he reads about Jesus, and he sees that Jesus has delivered him from his sin, and he cries out, "Oh, Son of David, God, please forgive me all my sins." And he says, "From that moment on, I was changed. I was born again." And then he shifts gears, and he says, "Now I add this part so that the reader may know that deliverance from sin is a much greater blessing than deliverance from affliction." That's what Abram is worried about. Certainly, all of us want to be delivered from affliction, but the big question is, are you delivered from your sin? And so Abram latches on to the promise of this heir, because the heir will be the one who will deliver him. And what does God say to him? Look at verses 4 and 5. It says, "Then the word of the Lord came to him, 'This man will not be your heir, but a son will come from your own body will be your heir.' And he took him outside and said, 'Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them.'" And basically God says, "Abram, trust me, he's coming, the heir is coming." And then you have the most beautiful line, almost in the whole Bible. What does God say to him? Or what does the Bible say? It says, "Abram believed the Lord, and he credited to him as righteousness." Why is this so beautiful? Think about it. God tells him the heir, that I promise you the heir is coming, and it says, Abram believed God. What did he believe? He believed God's promise. He trusted him. He said, "You know, I believe that you have the power to do what you have promised," but it was even more. You know what Abram believed in? The heir. Jesus. Because it says next, that says Abram believed and God credited it to him as righteousness. And most of us sort of make the mistake of thinking that the word, the antecedent to the pronoun, it, or what it refers back to, is Abram's faith. It doesn't, neither in the Hebrew nor in the English language. It just it says Abram believed, and God credited it. The antecedent to a pronoun can't be a verb. I hope that's not too complicated. What is it talking about? You've got to take it back one more step. It's this promise of the heir. That God credited to Abram the work or the promise of the heir. The blessing of the heir was credited to Abram. And God credited to him as righteousness. And we know that that heir was in fact Jesus. Remember when Jesus confronted the religious leaders and they said, "Our father is Abraham." And what did Jesus say to them? He said, "Abraham longed to see my day. He saw it and was glad." You see, Abram believed in Jesus. He didn't know his name. He didn't know how it would happen. But God says, "One of your heirs, one is coming who will take care of this whole problem. Trust me or not. Red pill or blue pill, Abram?" Red pill, you herd sheep the rest of your life and keep your nose clean. Blue pill, promise you nothing but the truth. And the truth is, Abram, you will be as righteous as that heir, because every single ounce of his righteousness will be credited to your account. You see, Abram looked forward to Jesus. We look back to Jesus. Abram looked forward. He had very little information except the promise that through this heir, God would fix his sin problem. We look backwards, and God says, "Through my heir, through Jesus, I will fix your sin problem." Now, we have a much better situation than Abram. Why? Because we look back, and we see this person of Jesus. We see his life. We see the fact that he went to the cross, and then he rose from the dead. And then he comes and he says, "When I am lifted up, will draw all men into myself." And God says, "You have the same responsibility as Abram. Will you trust my heir? Will you? Will you trust Jesus?" That's the question. And if you do, you know what it says? Tommy believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. David believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. How much work did Abram do to be credited with righteousness? You know, the text say, you know, Abram considered God's promise, and he went home, and he looked up a bunch of books about apologetics, and he really wanted to try and figure out whether or not there was a first cause. And if there was, then he would work himself forward, and then maybe he would believe. Or does it say that Abram went home, and he decided that he would really get his act straight? That he would stop sinning, and if he could just stop for a good long while, he would prove to himself that he was good enough to be accepted by God, and at that point he would step in and say, "Okay, God, now I'm ready to deal with you. I'm a much better person." It doesn't say that. You don't have to say that anywhere in the Bible, quite frankly. It says that Abram believed, in the midst of all of his nastiness, in the midst of all of his sin, in the midst of all of his brokenness, he believed. And it says that God simply credited to him or imputed to him righteousness. That made him righteous. It doesn't mean that he infused him with some kind of righteousness and Abram started acting better. It means that God just gave him the account of someone who is not his own. And that's what God does for us in Jesus on the cross. That if you trust Jesus, all of your sin is imputed to him. Every bit of it. Everything you've ever done or will do is imputed to him. And every bit of his goodness is imputed to you. Remember what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5? It says that on the cross, he became sin. Jesus did. So that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Right? So that on the cross, think of any nasty kind of sin you can imagine. Pedophile? No problem. On the cross, Jesus becomes, he takes on all the sin of the pedophile, and the pedophile becomes as righteous as Jesus. He'll just trust. Sexual deviance? On the cross, Jesus becomes that person. Why? So that you can become like him. On the cross, you know, Jesus says, I was Peter, that liar. I was Jacob, that denier. You know, all of these people, Jesus becomes. Why? So that we can become like him. And if you really understand the gospel, this is the core of every bit of it, that you don't do anything. And God comes and he says, because of the work of my son, I am willing to take you home gratis. And the biggest problem we all have is not wondering whether or not we are sinners, but whether or not we really believe that God could actually take us home gratis. And if you don't believe that, all you have to do is look at the cross. And every time you think that you are not worthy, you look at the cross and you say, yep, I'm not. But I've every bit of his righteousness, and that's the most beautiful thing in the world. And the more you grasp this, that God simply imputes to you or gives you the righteousness of Jesus, the more your life will change, right? Because first of all, you become more humble. You look at yourself and you say, man, I thought I was all that, but really I'm not. I was so wicked that I had to have the righteousness of someone else imputed to me. It had to be given to me. You become very humble. On the other hand, you become very bold, right? Why? Because you're as righteous as Jesus. You walk around and you say, you know, I'm walking around these streets, these people should be glad I live here. I'm as righteous as Jesus is. And if you're as righteous as Jesus, what does that mean for your life? Think about this. You know, have you ever thought about what would happen if you won the lottery? Right? Yeah, everyone has. You know, oh, if I won the lottery. Or you sit around, you know, you're playing some party game, right? I'm not excited about party games. But nonetheless, you're in, yeah, and you say, oh, what would you do if you won the lottery? And you begin to ponder, well, what happens if you did win the lottery? What would be the first thing you did? If you won the lottery, not only would you be extremely happy, but you would have a very extreme attitude adjustment, I'm guessing. Why? Because then you'd say, whew, I'm free. All my worries are gone. I can do whatever I want now. Well, you know what Jesus says? In the cross, you won the lottery. You win. You are as righteous as Jesus. Everything that he has is being given to you. And it's sort of like, Tommy Allen, you are as righteous as Jesus. What are you going to do now? Not go to Disney World. I'm going to do whatever I want. Why? Because once God's embraced me and given me the righteousness of Jesus, he would just as soon kick his own son out of the house. You see, the beautiful thing about the gospel is that God pursues you and pesters you until you get it. You know that. I know some of you may have read Traveling Mercies by Anne Lamott. That is a beautiful book. She's raised in a sort of 60s, extremely liberal, San Francisco, atheist, household, you know, where her parents are into all sorts of liberal activities. And when I say liberal, I mean sort of like communism almost, you know, that kind of thing. And she's raised to believe that there is no God and all these kinds of things. She becomes an adult and she's sort of just this sort of wild woman, you know. She has a very lascivious life and she's, you know, pregnant. At the point in the book I'm getting ready to talk to you, she's pregnant. She smokes a lot of pot. She drinks scotch all the time, and on Sunday morning she goes to the flea market in San Francisco just so she can hang out with all the freaks, you know. These are her words, not mine. And while she's at the flea market, she begins to hear music coming out of an African American church, just sort of gospel tunes. And she's drawn to it, and she'll always listen, but she'll never go in. She goes home. She listens and never goes in. She listens and never goes home. And then one night, she's simultaneously thinking to herself, I've got to be a better person. I'm a terrible person. I've got to be a better person. I'm a terrible person. And one night, she wakes up and she has a vision of Jesus sitting at the end of her bed. And she's scared. I'd be scared. And she says, go away. I don't want to have anything to do with you. And he leaves. And then she says, for the next 3 weeks, everywhere I went, I felt like someone was looking over my shoulder and there was a cat biting at my ankles. She says, then I woke up again one night and Jesus was there again. And he said, can I come in or not? And she uses bad words. She says, blank it. I quit. She says, I quit. Come on. That's where most of us are here. Whether you're a Christian or whether you're not a Christian. My guess is that most of us spend our lives striving to be acceptable and striving to have other people accept us and striving for some kind of affirmation. God says you don't have what it takes to get that affirmation. But I want to give it to you. Take it. And we're going, no, I'll do it myself. What most of us need to do is simply say, and not quit like you're leaving the faith, but I quit in order to get into the faith. And once you do that, then you start living life sort of like my daughter Mercy, right? This week, I often tell you stories, and the girls often make me cry. This week, the big thing I'm working on, you know, with my two older daughters, I've got them, right? When I walk in and I say, who's your daddy? They reply always, you're the man. And for Mercy, I've been working on that over and over and over and over. I say, who's your daddy? And she'll go,
Katie?
Or it's a cat. Someone. And Judy made all of our children. Mercy says these mommy and daddy tapes. Really, it's mommy does the whole thing, and daddy comes in at the end and says something, you know, with hymns and things, and Mercy listens to it. And on Mercy's daddy tape, I don't remember even saying this, but at the end of it, all I said was, Mercy, all I want you to remember is that Daddy loves you, and no matter what you do to me, you can never get kicked out of the house. And anyhow, I walked in her room the other day to help her with something, and I walked in the room, and she had that tape on, and my voice came on and said, Mercy. But before I could say it, she looked at me and said, I'm not out of the house. And I said, what do you mean? She says, I'm in the house. I said, Mercy, do you think you can never get kicked out of the house? She's like, yeah. And, you know, I'm certainly disappointed about the, you know, who's your daddy thing, but I'm very excited about this. And I went down, I ran downstairs, and I said, Judy, Mercy gets it, I think. She can't get kicked out of the house. You see, if God imputes to you the righteousness of his son, what he is saying is that you are as dear to me and you are as beloved to me as Jesus. You are not neutral. You're not neutral. You're not just forgiven and now you walk around and keep your nose clean. You are dear to God. And because of that, not only will he never let you go, but he will pursue your good. Think about that. Go out and celebrate Reformation Day. Let me pray. Jesus, I thank you that you would seem fit to go to the cross, that you would live the life we should have lived and died the death we should have died so that we might be credited with all of your work, with all of your righteousness. And because of that, God the Father, would be pleased with us and would rain benediction and blessing upon us. We thank you for that and praise you. In your name, amen.